Well, let's get started and talk a little bit about resources that are used in this. And the primary book that I've read on this issue is this book by William Harmless, and it's Augustine and the Catechumen. Great book. I'm a bibliophile. I don't say this very often. I don't say it loosely. But if you have anything to do with catechism in your church, you really ought to get this book. You really ought to get it. Now, he is a Jesuit. He wrote the book as a part of encouraging RCIA, which, if you don't know what that is, it's Roman Catholic Initiation for Adults, I think. Is that right? So it has a little bit of that at the beginning and a little bit at the end, but the rest in the middle is really about St. Augustine and his catechizer. So that is a phenomenal book. I highly recommend it. And I bought it a couple of years ago, actually, up here and had my book, and finally got around to reading it recently, I was very pleased. Also, as far as primary source goes, which Harmless used, the main book he uses from Augustine himself is a work called On the Catechizing of the Uninstructed. I was unaware of this. I've read a lot of Augustine, but I was unaware of this particular work. But what this work was, there was a catechist who was deacon in Carthage, the city of Carthage, and he wrote a letter to Augustine, who was bishop over in Hippo, also in North Africa, and basically said, hey, I'm a catechist, you know, I do a lot of catechizing of these new folks coming in, I don't think I'm doing a great job, you know, I really could use some guidance here. And so Augustine doesn't write a letter, he writes a treatise back to him, and apparently it's made public. So that's what this is. The man's name was Deo Gratias, was the catechist that he's writing to. So he addresses this work to him, and that's the primary work that you'll see. I'll make a couple of quotes in here from that particular work. I've read the work. It's great. As with Augustine, I don't know how much you've read of him. He's not exactly easy to read. I mean, the way he writes lends itself to slow reading. And most of us don't like to read slowly and thoughtfully, me included. But his work does really require that. Now, if you were to read this work, some of the stuff in it, you'd say, oh, it's not all that great. But every once in a while, frequently, I should say, you hit these nuggets and you're just like, wow. And so reading Augustine is like that. You know, you may struggle for portions of what he writes. You may not care about some of the stuff he writes, and that certainly will be true in this treatise that he does. But if you're willing to kind of work your way through it and listen to him and consider the context of it and what he's writing on, there are some great nuggets in there. He also wrote a bit more on catechizing. A lot of this comes through the sermons. You also see over here on Christian doctrine, which was really written for teachers. That makes my top 10 list of favorite books of all time. Augustine has two in there, Confessions and On Christian Doctrine. And then you'll see some other works on there which maybe help to understand his work of catechizing. Augustine considered himself to be first and foremost a Bible teacher. And you'll see that come through in this. So let's start off thinking about introduction. Why should we care about how Augustine practiced catechesis in 5th century North Africa? I mean, really. What can we learn from that? Well, Yaroslav Pelikan, another fine theologian, he tells us, and this is quoted by Harmless, he tells us that investigations into the Christian tradition offer us no prepackaged solutions, but give us a glimpse into the living faith of the dead. Admittedly, the burning concern of contemporary catechists must lie above all in the living faith of the living. Still, scholarly excavations of this living faith of the dead flow from a simple presumption that to nurture the living faith of the living, we need to include the dead within the circle of our discourse. Now, if you're familiar with G.K. Chesterton, he says something very much like that. Secondly, St. Augustine is one of the greatest thinkers that the church has ever produced, and his theology was hammered out as a pastor in North Africa, and so it's a privilege to be able to read him and learn from him. Thirdly, judging by the state of the contemporary church in the United States, we need help. fourthly, as an extension of our Lord's Great Commission, we all have the responsibility of seeing the gospel extended to all nations. This is especially the calling of the clergy, but lay people also have a role as sponsors to those whom they have brought to the church, and of course as catechists to their children in the home. We've heard that, for those of you who have been here for the last few days. We've heard a lot of that. That catechesis can't just take place at the church. It's not going to work. It's not working, right? So it needs to take place in the home as well. And so for all of these reasons, we should care about what Augustine is doing, and we should seek to learn from him. Well, let's get into the meat of this. Let's talk about the setting. The setting was in 5th century North Africa. This is the where of his catechesis, as I say here. Augustine was a priest and then a bishop in the city of Hippo from 391 to 430. He himself had undergone a lengthy conversion in catechesis under St. Ambrose, who was the bishop of Milan. And, of course, this influenced his later catechetical work. How many of you read Confessions, by the way? Okay, several of you read Confessions. He actually goes into this and talks a lot about this. You'll remember that he was trained in rhetoric, and, you know, his mother, Monica, of course, is a very devout Christian, and she's always encouraging him to come to church. He's read some of the scriptures. He's not impressed. He thinks it's, you know, not very good. And the mom keeps, you know, she's pestering me, so I'm going to go to church, you know. So he goes, when he gets to Milan, he goes and listens to Bishop Ambrose. He goes, this guy can speak. You know, as a rhetorician, he's impressed by the other rhetorician there. And so he's impressed with his speaking, and so he continues to come back and listen. And he says, you know, he didn't have very good material to work with, but hey, he does a great job with what he has. And over time, of course, he becomes convinced of the Christian faith and, of course, becomes a Christian. Now, according to Harmless, the alliance of church and state witnessed a high water mark in North Africa from 390 to 410. The result, as he says, was sometimes violent suppression of pagan practices. In North Africa, the Christians outnumbered the pagans, but many of the aristocrats, many of the most important people, were still pagans and, of course, resisted what the Christians were doing. There were also various groups beyond the pagans who were battling for the hearts and minds of the citizens of Hippo. And some of these would be the Arians, a group of heretics who denied the deity of Christ. That's what the First Ecumenical Council was called over. Just think Jehovah's Witnesses today. That's what the Arians were. The Donatists, a purist group in North Africa, which had arisen in the middle of the 3rd century following the Decian persecution. They were upset that some of the bishops and priests during the persecution had handed over copies of the scriptures that were burned by the Roman authorities. And so they felt like they had given up their right to be ministers in the church. And when, of course, the persecution subsided, many of them maintained their position in the church. The Donatists were upset, and so they ultimately want to separate and claim that they're the only pure, the only true church. So you have these Donatists who, in North Africa, who have separated and are claiming to be the pure church. We're not like those people, the Catholics over there, who have allowed the church to, you know, got all these infidels in it and so forth. The third group were the Manichaeans. And if you remember from Confessions, Augustine himself dabbled with the Manichaeans. He considered becoming a Manichaean himself. He never actually went into the initiation. He certainly was dabbling with it. And so the Manichaeans, probably the best way to describe them would be the Persian form of Gnosticism. You know what Gnosticism is? Gnosticism is this dualistic idea that the material world is bad, the spiritual world is good, so therefore our bodies are bad, but our spirits are good, and what we want to do is have our spirits released from our bad bodies. That's a very simplistic idea, but that's very much what the Manichaeans were. So therefore, they would deny certain things. You can't get married. You can't eat certain things, you shouldn't enjoy eating and all this kind of stuff. So it's really anti-Christian philosophy. But those were the Manichaeans. So
This is the context in which Augustine is ministering. As in our own day, there were many in the church who professed the name of Christ, but their lives betrayed their lack of true faith. Augustine refers to them frequently as the chaff of the church. And this is a problem, right? I mean, and I'm asking the question here about, think about the context in which Augustine is living. You should, as you hear this stuff, you should be thinking, wow, some of that is very similar to our own context. How difficult is it when we try to evangelize and try to bring someone to the church and they say, wow, but I want to become a Christian. Like, my neighbor over here, he said he's a Christian. He lives like that, you know. We have that problem, right? Well, Augustine had the same problem. And so we'll see how this comes through, actually, in his catechesis. He actually, he admits that there are many people like this in the church. So there is the where. This is where all of this is taking place. Now let's talk about the goal of his catechesis, and that is for conversion. And not a simplistic conversion as we hear today, getting somebody to say a sinner's prayer or what have you. We're talking about serious conversion is what he's looking for. So this is the why of his catechesis. He talks about the very needs of those who come to be catechized in his work, this treatise of Deo Gratias. He notes three groups: the unlearned, the well-educated, and the ordinary educated. Each group necessitates its own approach to catechesis. Special attention must be given to those, as he says, who walk a bit slower. So I was joking yesterday, for those of you used to listen to the radio, Christian radio, you hear Dr. J. Vernon McGee come on. Dr. J. Vernon McGee, he said at one point, you can't put the cookies on the top shelf. You got to put the cookies on the bottom shelf so everybody can have some cookies. So that's the sense of what Augustine's saying is, hey, look, you can't just put everything up here. You've got to put it down where everybody can enjoy it. And so that's the point, is to make sure that the information is accessible to everyone. Now, in Augustine's church, there were four phases of initiation. If you were here at Father Nelson's session the other day, he talked about this. And it's very similar. So there are four phases of this initiation. The first phase in this process of coming into the church, the first phase was evangelization. And this is, if we were to sort of put a name to this, this would be an inquirer or a seeker. Right? This is someone who has heard something about the Christian faith. They come to the church and they say, I'd like to hear some more about this Christian faith. And maybe I've seen a neighbor who I'm impressed with, or, I've seen a friend over here, or a family member, what have you. So they want to come to the church to hear about the Christian faith. It's an investigation of Christian faith. So you'd have a catechist there who would meet them and speak to them about the church. He was appointed to do that. And his first job was to find out, what is it that is drawing you to the Christian faith? Augustine notes several possibilities. Various motives include the fear of God, meaning the idea of judgment after this life. He actually says that's the most common. Secondly, revelation through dreams. And then thirdly, having been witness to some sort of miraculous event. Someone being healed, something like that. Now, while Augustine did not necessarily, here's a technical word for you, poo-poo such motivations, he hoped to divert their attention to more trustworthy sources, namely the scriptures and the oral teaching given on them. Okay, so notice that he doesn't necessarily say, and I think this is actually very wise, he doesn't say that God can't use things like that. We all know God can, right? God can use things like that. But when these folks come in, what Augustine says is, we want to redirect you to more certain witnesses, namely the scriptures. At this point, there would be an unrolling of the scroll, as it's called, meaning to give the case for Christianity. Now, interestingly enough, some of you
did that. And I think it's a great idea.
Augustine did the same thing at this evangelization phase. When these folks would come, they're interested in the Christian faith. He didn't start off by saying, you're a sinner and Jesus died for you. He didn't start off there. He said, tell the whole story. Start with creation. Go through not just to, you know, what happens in Jesus' life, but actually including church history up to the point in which he's ministering. Now that's interesting, right? And part of the reason for doing that was he wanted to show that many of the things that had happened in church history were the fulfillment of various prophecies and things that Jesus and the Old Testament prophets had said. So not just the drama of redemption as contained in the scriptures, but even going beyond that to talk about what happens afterward. So look at what he says here. It's a lengthy quote. This is from Augustine. The narration is full when each person is catechized in the first instance from what is written in the text. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, meaning Genesis 1, on to the present times of the church. That's what I'm talking about, up to the present day, roughly 400. This does not imply, however, either that we ought to repeat by memory the entire Pentateuch and the entire book of Judges and Kings and Esdras and the entire Gospel and Acts of the Apostles, if we have learned all these word for word, or that we should put all the matters which are contained in these volumes into our own words and in that manner unfold and expand them as a whole. For neither does the time admit of that, nor does any necessity demand it. But what we ought to do is to give a comprehensive statement of all things, summarily and generally, so that certain of the more wonderful facts may be selected which are listened to with superior gratification and which have been ranked so remarkably among the exact turning points of the history that instead of exhibiting them to view only in their wrappings, we may so speak, and then instantly snatching them from our sight, we ought to dwell on them for a certain space and thus, as it were, unfold them and open them out to vision and present them to the minds of the hearers as things to be examined and admired. But as for all other details, these should be passed over rapidly and thus far introduced and woven into the narrative. So what he's saying is, as you go through, hit the highlights, hit the major turning points, talk about the major figures, Noah, Abraham, you know, it's simple. But tell the story. Tell the story of the history of redemption. Now, this narrative was to be followed up with an exhortation focusing on the Christian vision of the future, which includes, first, the resurrection of the body. Now, you know, this is especially repugnant to the philosophers. Resurrection of the body. Why? Here's some of that dualistic mentality here now. Why in the world would you want to have the body resurrected? You remember St. Paul, when he goes to Mars Hill, Acts chapter 17, he runs into this. He starts talking about the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And they say, oh, lost your soul. We've never heard about this before. So he wanted to make sure they understood this. And part of this is because the pagans outside of the church, if you said you were a Christian, they would berate you. Oh, you believe in the resurrection of the body? Right? You're an idiot. Secondly, warning the inquirers about trials that would be faced from those outside of the church. That sort of fits in with what I was just saying. Third, the fact that many who bore the name of Christ did not live as they ought. And here, of course, is Augustine's view of the church being made up of both wheat and tares. This is Jesus' parable in Matthew chapter 13. It was this acknowledgement that in the field, you have both wheat and tares. And you don't uproot the tares, because if you uproot the tares, you may also what? Uproot the wheat with it. So therefore, you allow them to grow, and at the final judgment, the angels will come, and they know who belong to Christ. So Augustine is acknowledging that the church does have within its membership people who are not truly devoted to Jesus Christ. And so it's interesting that at this point he acknowledges this to these folks who are coming to be evangelized, and he also warns them about it. Don't act like them. In fact, find some godly people that you can emulate. For those who were interested, now here you go. For those who were interested, so these are folks, remember, this is this evangelization phase. They come to the church, they want to know about the Christian
faith, for those who are interested in taking the next step in this, these four phases of initiation, they would be brought into the church as a catechumen. That is, a person who is being under instruction in the church. A person who is being instructed in the ways and teachings of the church. Now, so that moves us to the second phase. And we're talking about these four phases, talking about evangelization, namely an inquirer. Okay? The inquirer comes in, he hears the story, he hears all these things, and he says, ah, yes, I would like to become a Christian. So that moves into the second phase, namely to become a catechumen. Those inquirers indicated the one who become Christians were brought into the church with a ceremony which included three rites. The first thing would happen is the Augustine would lay his hands on them and presumably pray for them. Secondly, he would actually sign them with the sign of the cross. And then he would sprinkle some salt into their mouths in preserving and seasoning the candidate. But it's him. You hear some of these rites. It sounds very familiar to other things we would do. But it is, and this is one of the, I'm glad you asked that question, because in this second phase, these folks who are catechumens, even though they're not technically full members of the church, they are considered to be under the care of the church. And they would even say, I'm a Christian. They were considered to be Christians. Now, if you remember your church history back in the early church, you had some folks like Perpetua, who was not baptized, but was, I don't think she was at the point when she was martyred. But those who were martyred before they were baptized, their martyrdom was considered to be their baptism. It was a baptism of blood. So if you were a catechumen and you were martyred in that phase before you could be baptized, then your martyrdom was considered to be a baptism of blood. So you were, in some sense, considered to be a part of the church. You were, you know, you were under the care of the church. Now, I'll come to a metaphor, and that's right where we have it, 2B. It's helpful to mention a metaphor in Augustine's thought concerning the church and these candidates. This whole process is viewed in familial terms. Of course, God being the Father, the church is the mother, the candidate is the potential child. The process of becoming a catechumen was viewed as their conception. So when they're brought into the church, this is like their conception. Okay? In a nutshell, by becoming a catechumen, the person was coming under the care of the church. Now, we'll come back. How many of you are familiar with this whole metaphor of the church being our mother? This is not just a Roman Catholic thing, by the way. This is very much a traditional understanding of the church. If you've ever read John Calvin's Institutes of the Christian Religion, when he begins his section of the church in Book 4, the very first metaphor that he uses for the church is the church is our mother. He quotes this this dictum of St. Cyprian back in the 3rd century. You cannot have God for your father unless you have the church for your mother. So it's that same metaphor. A lot of biblical images for this, but our epistle lesson on the fourth Sunday in Lent, we call it Mothering Sunday, but the epistle lesson is from St. Paul's letter to the Galatians, where he talks about Jerusalem above, which is the mother of us all. So he's talking about the church being our mother. And so that's the image in here. So keep that in mind. We'll hit on that a couple more times, but I did want to mention that. 2C, the catechumen, it could last for 3 years or even longer. Some people would postpone their baptism, in part, some of them didn't want to go to the next phase because it was hard. And others wanted to just be able to kind of sow their wild oats. One day, I'll be baptized. There were probably some others still at this point who were hesitant to be baptized, because they were worried about committing some heinous sin after baptism that they then could not be forgiven for. So this is a problem, right? And the church has to kind of work through this. The way this happens, you have a whole bunch of catechumens in the church, and these catechumens are brought in, and they sort of come into the care of the church. They're not baptized, but they would be able to come to the first half of the worship service, okay? This is still, I think, in the East called the Liturgy of the Catechumens. You'd be coming in to basically minister the word. In our context, it would be the anti-communion. Up to, where we
creed. Okay? So it's basically a ministry of the word.
They're not heard the Lord's Prayer either, by the way.
So they would come in to be able to listen to the reading of the scriptures, listen to Augustine preach. That was what they were privy to.
Okay?
Now, at the end of this portion of the service, the catechumens were to leave because they could not participate in the Eucharist. In fact, we'll find out in just a few moments, they didn't know anything about, very little, if anything, about sacraments. Now, by the way, there's still this remnant in the Eastern liturgy where, at this point of the service, the deacon goes to the back of the church and he says, "The doors!" And that's a symbol for all of you folk who are not baptized into the church to be. You are not allowed to stay because you cannot participate in the Eucharist. So that's what's going on here, that they would not be able to stay. Now, it's hard to say what exactly would happen with them, whether they would go out of the country. Somebody mentioned the other day, I think Father Nelson mentioned they'd go out in the courtyard for further instruction. That's very likely. I think probably right. But they would not be allowed to stay for the Eucharist. Now, it was during this time, meaning while they're as catechumens coming into the liturgy of the catechumen, I'm sorry if that's not clear here, that Augustine would break open the bread of the word to them. I love the metaphor. He would break open the bread of the word to them. That is, he did most, if not all, of his catechizing in his sermons, which would last about an hour. Harmless brings out, by the way, just fascinating information about his congregation there, his audience. You know, he'd be talking about introducing some person from the scriptures and so this man went down and he came into contact with a lion and they'd say, "Samson!" They were in the show, they knew the story, they knew the scriptures, right? And at one point they would, or several points, apparently, if he didn't preach long enough, they would boo him. I have not experienced that.
But hey, you know, I'm not a Augustine either. But
I get both sides of this.
Oh, my word. You know, some other people say, y'all go talk to each other over there. This is very interesting stuff coming out.
But in several of his sermons, you know, he would catechize in the midst of the sermons. He would turn to the catechumens and say, "Now, you catechumens, especially like if he made passing reference to baptism of the Lord's Supper, he turned to the catechumens, and all of, you know, of course, the whole, you know, all of his parish members know what he's talking about. But they turn to the catechumens and say, "You catechumens don't know what I'm talking about, but you just hold on, you'll find out about it." Sort of a teaser. Around Epiphany, now you've got all these catechumens in the church, remember, he would begin to encourage them, those catechumens who wanted to be baptized at the Easter Vigil, to give their names. So notice, this is the transition. We talked about evangelization, we have an inquirer, to a catechumen who actually comes into the church through this rite of laying on hands and crossing and sprinkling salt. They're brought into the church, essentially, under the care of the church, but not full members, not fully initiated. So now you've got all these folks out here around the time of Epiphany, and Augustine begins to say, "All right, you people who want to, you catechumens who want to enter into full initiation in the church, I want you to come forward, I want you to give me your name, and we'll enroll you into this next phase." Okay? Now this next phase, you will become known as a competentus. Petitioner or co-petitioner, we'll get to that in just a second, but you actually are moving. Notice these phases of initiation, very clear. So, by the way, when you gave your name, it wasn't just, you give your name, you actually had to have a sponsor or sponsors who would come and vouch for you. Yes, I know Nathan, he's been my neighbor for 3 years. I know, you know, he's been coming to church, been a catechumen for 3 years, and I've watched his life, I've seen him being transformed, you know, I see how he treats his wife, how he treats his kids, how he conducts his business, and so forth. Okay. Alright. You're in. You're in this. So notice, you couldn't just their morality is like a transition here. It's like a barrier here. If you were not really serious, they didn't want that touch. Yes.
I'm imagining someone walking into a Baptist church or something and saying, "Now you need to pray three letters of recommendation." Or open the door.
You'd have these sponsors who would say, "Yes, you're really serious." So that brings you into this third phase. You become a competentist during the Lent. Okay, so notice he starts in the 15th, trying to encourage people to give their names, and then at the start of Lent, that's when you actually move into this next phase, spiritual boot camp, as Harmless calls it, for the next 40 days. Now, following out our metaphor, remember the church being our mother, and you know, this would be the phase of time in the womb. The boot camp for these petitioners, the competentists, included the following disciplines. At the beginning of Lent, they would have to stand on a goat skin and bare feet. I'll tell you, it's rough. I don't think that's song off the same way, perhaps. But they would turn to the west and renounce the devil. And this, of course, was the first of several scrutinies and exorcisms, actually. They would be expected to fast over the 40 days until 3 o'clock. And even then, even after 3 o'clock, no meat, no alcohol, which, you know, for people living on the Mediterranean is probably very difficult. They would attend daily instruction at the church. If they were married, there would be no sexual relations during Lent. And no bath, interestingly enough. Now, I speculate that maybe those two are going to hell.
You sleep over there, I'll sleep over there.
They would also participate in what was called prayers, and this typically for them means like an all-night prayer ritual. And almsgiving was very important. If you were wealthy, they may ask you to give a considerable amount of your wealth away. Now, can you think of a biblical story where that would come in? What's that based on? The rich young ruler, right? Where the rich young ruler comes to Jesus and says, "What must I do to inherit the kingdom of heaven?" Jesus said, "What does Scripture say?" "You obey all these commandments. I've done all that." Yeah. Right. Jesus says, "Well, then go and take all you have, sell it, give it to the poor, and come follow me. You have treasure in heaven." What happens to the rich young ruler? He goes away downcast because he had great wealth. So this is a way to sort of test. You're really serious. You're really serious about following Christ? Augustine would frequently berate the people who were living extravagant lifestyles while their neighbors and other folks around them were scratching and scraping to even get a meal. Now, in the midst of all this, 2 weeks before Easter, they would be given the creed by Augustine. Now, just think of it. This is so bizarre to think about. Up until this point, they'd never heard the creed. They don't know anything about baptism. They don't know anything about the Lord's Supper. They don't even know the Lord's Prayer. So up to this point, 2 weeks ahead of time, this is in the middle of Lent, or a little later, past the middle of Lent, this is when they come to the church and Augustine gives them the creed. He actually hands it over to them. And so he would go through and recite the creed to them, give them the creed, and he would actually give an exposition. He'd explain it. Now, the next week, you are not coming to service. A who? Good gracious, man. All right, I'm going to move along. All right, so they would come in, and the following week, they would be expected to come in, recite it back. So you have a week to learn the creed.
which for an oral culture probably wasn't that difficult. But they would have their sponsors would actually help them with this. So the next week they come back and they give it back to Augustine. Some of this should sound, you know, we've heard this in the sessions. Now, it's the following week when they're actually given the Lord's Prayer to memorize. It's also around this time that they go for another exorcism when, I guess, one of the ministers or perhaps Augustine himself hits them. It was a way of showing contempt for the devil. And so it's like another exorcism. I really got to do a little more exploring on that. I don't think about that.
I might have some people I want to hiss at.
Now, we move to the fourth phase, which is this mystagogy. Mystagogy really just means the teaching of mystery. In this case, we're talking about primary sacraments. Now, notice it's not until this point that they really begin to learn anything about the sacraments. In Hippo, this took place primarily during the Triduum, the 3 days from Holy Thursday through Holy Saturday. On Thursday, they would get to break the fast and to take a bath, which, remember, was typically in public baths. So we don't normally think about these cultural things, but it was typically down at a public bath. On Saturday, they would recite the creed publicly and receive a sermon on the meaning of baptism. Incidentally, in this final phase of their initiation, Augustine saw himself as the appointed midwife. So here the metaphor mixes a little bit, presumably to bring forth the child, bring forth the child being born, again in baptism. But the metaphor really is mixed, is mentioned in here. Marlis mentions that he coaches them through labor. So notice how he doesn't mind mixing up metaphors here, but very similar ideas. At the vigil, they would be baptized and chrismated and anointed with holy oil in a separate place at a baptistry. Then they would be brought into the worship where they would finally get to see the Eucharist and participate in it. Interestingly enough, as far as we know, no instruction on the Eucharist. Just come in and see it. Now, following that, that's when they would get instruction. On Easter Day, the next day, they would come back for another celebration of the Eucharist, and typically where they get some instruction on the mysteries. Now, for the next 8 days, these neophytes, as they're called, by the way, when you're baptized, you would go in, you wear your old clothes, you're baptized typically naked. Now, this wasn't like out in the middle of the church like we would do, but you were baptized naked. You would take off your old garments, go into the waters, be baptized, come out on the other side, you were baptized and chrismated, come out on the other side, and put a white robe on you, and all. You just saw the folks who were serving the room, you would wear it all. And you would wear that all for the next 8 days. All in town. Coming into the church. And as he says, these Neophytes are becoming living icons to the church as a whole. During those 8 days, they were expected to come to daily services where they would receive deeper instruction of faith. By the way, St. Cyril of Jerusalem has some of this mystagogy. You would come in and receive further instruction into what you had just experienced. Now, here's the curriculum, the what of his catechesis. At this point, you may be thinking, if they didn't receive the creed, the Lord's Prayer, and the sacraments really until right at Easter, what in the world did he talk about during all of his catechesis? Well, assuming they had a grasp of redemptive history, which of course he would rehearse, that was, remember, primarily done in the evangelization phase, Augustine would build upon their knowledge of the scriptures, stressing especially the sum of the biblical message, namely the love of God and the love of one's neighbor. I need to give away the book, but if you read on Christian Doctrine, where he talks to these teachers and he says, hey, look, you're teaching the Bible, there's a lot of things you need to talk about. Of course, you can talk about all these various figures and all this stuff. But he says, if your final message is not for them to love God and to love their neighbor, then you have missed the point. You don't understand the scriptures. So this, for him, and you'll notice I give you a couple of quotes to this end, this is preeminent instruction. So we're learning to love God and to love neighbor. Top of the next page, or I'm sorry, I skip past the quotes. Augustine was adamant about weaving together faith, meaning doctrine, and morals. None of the separating stuff. For Augustine, persuasion was the bottom line, and by persuasion he meant not nodding assent, but moral living. Harmless notes that during one Lent, Augustine was preaching daily through the Gospel of John, aiming at the mind, and through the Psalter, aiming at the heart. Now, Bishop Sutton talked about this the other day, this idea of our conversion being this understanding of bringing heart and mind back together in harmony. Heart and mind. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. Right? So he wants to bring this together. Another interesting story. Sometimes his audience is the congregation would cheer. He would say something profound, and by the way, he said a lot of profound stuff. He would give me these little raps, almost rap he does, where he puts all these puns and things together, and the audience would clap. They said, "Hey, save your clapping. Don't clap for me because I said something that you like. I would much prefer to see you live it." So that's the mindset of Augustine, is living out the faith. Now, taking all of this into consideration, notice that Augustine has followed the ancient model of catechesis. He has the ethical Ten Commandments summarized in the dual commandments, to love God and love neighbor. Remember, Jesus says, "On these two commandments hang all the law and prophets." Every week in our liturgy. Secondly, he's brought in the doctrinal, that's the creed. And then thirdly, the spiritual, the Lord's Prayer and the sacraments. Now, there's a whole lot more here that I wish I could get into, but let's just think for just a moment, the last couple of minutes that we have. What is there in this that is very strange and we can't imagine being implemented in the church today? Or, secondly, things in here that we see that the church is not doing that we may want to adopt? I'll open that up for you. Your thoughts.
Keeping the sacraments and the full service of the Eucharist from people for that length of period of time and preventing them from being baptized for that length of period of time seems problematic to me. And it seems like you can still get a lot of what he's doing with something more along the lines of what we do with confirmation, maybe making that a little bit more formal.
Yeah.
But still have this rite of initiation. Yeah, I just don't see Christ laying those kinds of barriers to coming to him in that way.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course we make a distinction between children of believing parents and, of course, folks who are just coming in willy-nilly with no Christian background. Maybe they're coming from a pagan background or from a different group, you know, a sect, whatever. I think you're going to have some ability to discern where they are. And that may be this sort of this evangelization phase. I do think we're probably a little too much in a hurry for some of these folks. And I'll be glad to cover this later on. I don't want to do it on the microphone here, but I'd be glad to talk about this later, personal experience of some of this. Depending on where they're coming from, we may want to kind of slow down. Now, if you've got somebody who's been in the evangelical church their whole lives and they've just never been baptized, then we might move them along quicker because they just, you know, for whatever reason, the church hasn't pushed baptism or, you know, and by the way, this is very common today that people are filled in the evangelical churches and haven't been baptized. I mean, they've been going to church for 10 or 15, 20 years. Never saw the need for it, you know, because, hey, why would you? It doesn't mean anything, right? So, you know, we do need to look at this and probably do some discernment as to how we bring folks along. But we're in some ways in a similar context, in other ways a very different context. So, those are things that we need to think about, though. Just think.
It's like expecting them to come to church and then expecting them to be they don't have to really change.
some sense, you know, as Aretheans, I think, well, you know, we need the Spirit of God to help us and into our lives and so forth. And so you wonder how to kind of balance that. But look, if God is drawing you, the Spirit of God is at work in your heart and mind, there is already some transformation taking place. I mean, some of the things that were pleasant to you before may become less pleasant almost immediately. Now, of course, we all know that our lives will change in a moment. It's not fast food transformation by any stretch, but you know, when the Spirit of God is working in us, we're being transformed even before being baptized, I think. So that's what we should see.
Going along with what she said, I think there is some wisdom in extending time a little longer, maybe a year, but a little longer, because that way the novelty wears off for so many Christians. Like they think from the rose garden being a Christian, but if it's drawn out and they go through Lent and like almsgiving and fasting, they realize this isn't something easy. But a lot of Christians would say it's the novelty of it all, it's so exciting.
Yeah.
And then it's like the seed being plucked from the thorn.
Here's a great passage to tie in and help us think about that. Luke chapter 14, where Jesus talks a lot about discipleship in that passage, and it's where he talks about counting the cost. Read Luke 14. There, Jesus says, unless you hate your father and mother, you can't be my disciple. Unless you're willing to give up all that you have, you can't be my disciple. Let me say to Jesus, are you trying to get people to follow you or not? Right? Well, he goes in, of course, and tells some stories about counting costs. You need to count costs. You're going to come up here and you must deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow him anyway. So that self-denial requires some serious reshuffling of priorities and so forth. And so perhaps this period, the church worked out a way of people counting the cost. Before you start, count the cost.
Yeah, that was like in that secret section, it was really interesting. You don't think of when, you know, the new person's supposed to copy on or whatever, second, but yeah, you're going to be persecuted, you will be despised, you know, it's going to be rough, you know, the world is going to be crazy. Enemy
of
the devil, all sorts of things, and we don't think of that
when
there's a new guy. You know, you don't
want to hear a word. Yeah, I think we ought to be realistic. You know, how many gospel presentations have you heard? Let me put quotation marks around gospel. How many quote unquote gospel presentations have you heard where you come to Jesus and your life's going to be wonderful and filled with joy? Baloney. Baloney. If you're giving people that and telling people that coming to follow Jesus, that's what it's going to be like, you are giving them unrealistic expectations. And in the long run, you actually may be doing them a disservice. Because when they come to Jesus and all hell breaks loose in their lives, what did I sign up for? Get me out of here. Right? So I really think we ought to be more realistic. And those are in my church. I go through this all the time. I mean, I say, look, this is not this is not the easy way. I'm the anti-Joel Osteen, by the way. It's all sugary sweet for him. I don't know. It isn't either. That's a lie. I mean, when you sign up, you're entering. Here's a little metaphor. You're entering the army of Christ. His enemies are going to be your enemies. The world hated me. Guess what? Hate Jesus. In this world ye shall have tribulation. It'll be a good cheer by the come to world. The world reflects the devil. Yeah, boy, I really want to sign up for that. Those enemies. So I think we do need, there's some things that we need to listen to in this and say, you know what? There's some wisdom here that we might want to back up. And I think this was mentioned the other day in one of the sessions. You know, somebody comes in and visits and then they leave. You know, oh, please come back. You know, if God is at work in their lives and if they come and hear the gospel, they're going to be drawn back. Then we need to be kind, of course.
But some people are and some people don't.
That's true. It's striking about that. You know, in our church, we've had folks who have been kind of put off because they're by swarming, you know. So you've got to strike a balance there. Not swarming, but not being a friendly either. And so, this may be something that you have some certain folks appointed who have the gift of sort of carrying on a conversation. Where do you come from? And what church have you gone to? Are you Christian? So you have some people who are able to do that. Never have a stranger sort of people. They may be good people in your congregation to say, when a new person comes in, won't you find out who they are, or where they're coming from, and all that good stuff. So there's some things I think that we can implement here that will be very helpful for our church in the long run, churches in the long run. But we certainly need to do a better job. I don't think there's any question about that. We all